Well, I want to thank you all for coming this evening. I know sometimes the title that you choose can maybe persuade people to maybe, especially when the pastor's out of town, play a night of hooky or something, but I'm glad that you're here. I also want to thank the Chris Ed Committee for inviting me to speak. And the funny thing is, I'm on the Chris Ed Committee, and we were thinking of topics for the Summer Truth Forum, and somehow global warming came up, and I said something, and then someone who's already spoken this evening in the back row there, Sherry, said to me, "That sounds like something that you could do." And then Pastor was there, and here I am. So thank you all for that. Okay. I got to hit one more button here. Okay. So, global warming. We want to look at this from a biblical perspective. Why should you even care about global warming? In our day and age, it's a reason or excuse, or however you view it now, for some pretty profound changes in the laws of our nation and a lot of the civilized or advanced modern nations in the world. Entails a lot of extra regulations, and it's just the way our whole society views their mission in life. And the term that kind of encompasses that is Zeitgeist, and that's a German term. And I was going to pick on an Argentinian person here this evening, since Germany just defeated Argentina in the World Cup final, but I guess John's home consoling her about that loss. But Zeitgeist, it just tries to capture with one word the intellectual, the moral, and the cultural climate of an era. And you see more and more the zeitgeist of our age focused on global warming and how it has all these profound impacts on everything that goes on. And so what that entails then is a lot of the resources of our society's intellect, our people's innovation, scientific and social energy is being directed toward addressing the problem that global warming presents. So who cares about the zeitgeist, right? We're fundamentalists, we're separatists, we're not really concerned about that. But what happens is global warming is used by different groups, legislatures, regulators, celebrities, you name it, as a reason to call us to worship at the altar of global warming. Now that's a pretty strong statement to say, the altar of global warming. Now, why do I say that? Because really, I want to show tonight that this is a modern version of an old problem that mankind has. With this global warming zealots, essentially the idol that they want us to worship is Earth's preservation. They say that the entire globe depends on what you and you and you and me do or don't do. And then what they do to convince you that this is the truth is they want to wrap it in scientific legitimacy, make you think of it the same way you think of the law of gravity, and get action out of us. And what I want to show this evening is essentially how accepting this idea of global warming theory of global warming destroying the globe is really a matter more of faith than it is of scientific fact, at least at the present time. I like this slide because it's got the Earth in a frying pan. Essentially, the theory, let's understand what the theory says before we start to look at its scientific legitimacy. Theory, it's very basic, says that increased carbon dioxide, CO2, which is a greenhouse gas, causes an increase in the greenhouse effect. What's the greenhouse effect? You get into your car on a winter day when it's 25 degrees and it's nice and sunny. You get in your car, it's nice and toasty in there. Solar energy is coming into your car. It's trapped by the glass that's in there and it gets nice and warm. They're saying carbon dioxide does the same thing in the atmosphere. As the atmosphere warms up, all these horrible things happen. There's more drought, there's rising oceans that flood the world, and we end up cooking the earth and killing it like that in that frying pan. Now, to understand sort of the extent of global warming and why it's something I wanted to talk about this evening, you have to look at the sources of these greenhouse gases. There are several. carbon dioxide is the one that's in the news all the time because it comes from these two big important things. It comes from burning fossil fuels, coal, oil, gas. That runs our world. This building is here because we burn fossil fuels. We're watching this presentation. We're comfortable because of fossil fuels. Our modern civilized life depends on burning fossil fuels. Funny thing about carbon dioxide is we also produce it when we breathe. So I've been making a lot of it. You're making it. Your dog makes it. Anything that breathes oxygen makes carbon dioxide. So it comes from a lot of places. There are other greenhouse gases, and actually what people don't get transmitted to them is water vapor is actually the biggest greenhouse gas. You know this from winter nights when there's a lot of snow on the ground and forecasters say, well, there's no cloud cover tonight, so it's going to be very frigid because all the cold just escapes up into the atmosphere and it just gets colder. If there's cloud cover, it's usually a little bit warmer. And there's a lot of water vapor in the world. So that's a big source of greenhouse effect. And then there's methane. I don't mean to profane our surroundings here, but just to show you how zealous people are, methane comes from livestock digestive processes. And I don't bring that up just to get a chuckle out of everyone, but because this is seriously being studied. And when it gets studied, it's seriously being considered to be regulated. Livestock is an important part of human life, and so you see that it can have an impact. So we cursory review of where greenhouse gases come from. They're practically from everywhere, everything, and everyone. And so when zealots look at this and say, oh, we're going to cook the earth if we don't reduce these, that's going to demand that there be a dramatic sweeping change in the way people live, and they talk about transforming human society to get these gases to come down and save the planet. And they say we need to do this because it's scientifically proven that this is happening. So, is it scientifically legitimate? A couple ways to look at science, and Joel's not here, but I think he'd agree with what I'm saying here. Global warming is not subject to investigation by the classic scientific method. So this is a complicated chart that I have to bring up so that it looks like I'm a scientist. Scientific method, and I'll give you an example of this. You make an observation, come up with a theory for why that happens, a hypothesis. You do some experiments where you hold all the variables the same except for the one that you're looking at. You look at your data over here, and you see if your conclusion supports your hypothesis over here. To understand that a little more easily, it's an example of you've maybe been in a junior high science fair or helped someone with a junior high science fair project, and probably the most basic one, and this is out of Highlights magazine. Little girl here, she has two jars of water, equal amounts of water. Her hypothesis is that if you put salt in water, that'll lower the freezing temperature. So she pours a measured amount of salt in this one. So this jar has water. This has water and salt. She puts them both into this freezer back there, and she measures how long it takes each of them to freeze, or if they even do freeze. Pretty simple. Scientific method at play right there. So can't do that with the Earth. You can't have one Earth with carbon dioxide that it's at this level and another Earth with more carbon dioxide in the same orbit and see which one gets hotter, if it gets hotter or not. So we can't do a scientific method experiment to determine if this theory is legitimate, but that's not a problem. Science has another idea. They say, well, if a theory has good predictive value, that's a good theory. So, example of this. If you make lots of accurate predictions about future conditions, you're good to go. Theory of gravity. If I drop this remote, it's gonna hit this podium at a certain speed with a certain amount of force. You can extrapolate that out to figure out the orbit of the moon around the Earth and the moon around the sun, and predict when the next solar eclipse is going to happen. If that date comes and there's a solar eclipse, good. If that date comes and there isn't a solar eclipse, you better rethink your theory because it's just been proven wrong. So, what predictions does global warming theory make? They say as carbon dioxide goes up, temperature's gonna go up. Good enough. I like it. Here's the problem. This is what they term the pause in global warming. There's been no global warming occurring in the past 17 years. So we have a lot of people 17 and under here who've heard a lot about global warming their entire life, and surprise, it hasn't been occurring. Now this is kind of confounding because today was the day that the atmosphere had the most carbon dioxide in it ever in recorded time. Yesterday was the previous record, because every day there's more growth, there are more people on Earth, there's more factories put up, there's just more. So every day for the past 17 years has been a record-setting day for carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And yet, even though models predicted it, there has been no rise in global temperatures. Another complicated graph, few lines here. They made these models, and they said, well, if the models aren't that accurate, the temperature could go up this high. They gave a range of temperatures. It could go, here's zero, and here's the change in the amount of temperature this direction. And if our models get the low estimates here, and our best estimate is this line right here. These black lines are the actual recorded temperatures. And if you do some math and fit the data to the best slope here to get an average slope, the slope runs underneath here. And the slope that they come up with is really no different than what they've seen historically. So they call this the pause. Now, this terminology is interesting because they call it the pause. Well, global warming indicates warming, and here we've got a pause. So they say, well, it's global warming's still happening, it's just not happening right now. It's a pause. Okay, that should kind of make you scratch your head, because we've had 17 years of incorrect predictions in spite of this record-setting amount of carbon dioxide, and you've been wrong. That would make most people think maybe something's wrong with the theory, but no, it's just a pause. It's still happening. It's just has been happening for a decade plus. Now this gets us into kind of a philosophical problem, because now we're starting to redefine the theory to fit the facts. The theory is supposed to predict the facts. You're not supposed to find the facts and then change the theory and say that's the truth. There's a guy much smarter than me, Karl Popper. He's an Austrian philosopher of science, and he came up with this kind of concise statement that he said, a scientific theory which is not refutable by any conceivable event is not scientific. The fact that it cannot be refuted is not a virtue of a theory. As people often think, what a great theory, it explains everything. It's actually a vice. Kind of an example going along with what we've got here. Will we still be calling it global warming if the pause lasts 25 years, or if the pause lasts 50 years, or if the pause is 100 years long? It's not global warming anymore, so that theory's not working. So what happens is global warming, whatever happens, they explain that as part of the theory, even though it doesn't match predictions. Well, temperatures aren't going up. It's a pause. The heat's in the ocean. It's over there. We didn't predict it was in the ocean, but that's where it is. Well, the Arctic ice is melting, so that's global warming. But at the same time, Antarctic ice levels are at record levels, which is not part of the prediction. So they say, well, you just need to tweak the models. Well, tweaking the models and getting into this problem of creating a theory that explains everything is a problem. And then you'll see this in kind of the lay press a lot of times. Any weather event, or any event actually, will be explained by global warming. So President Obama was in California. They were having a terrible drought out there. It's due to global warming. You have a lot of flooding in the Midwest. It's global warming. They even blame blizzards on global warming, because they say, well, there's the air that comes up from the south is warmer, it has more moisture, and then when it hits the cold air, you get more snow precipitation events. Then they kind of, there's some random things out there. They'll say, oh, there's going to be drought, so there's going to be wars over water in the future, even though never in human history has there been a fight over water. And I even saw a headline, I didn't even bother to read it. It said, no more redheaded people in the future because of global warming. So it gets kind of silly, because it explains everything. So, and what this is an example of, there's nothing you can tell someone to convince them that global warming doesn't exist. Earth's not warming up for the past 17 years, it's still global warming. So that's two problems with global warming, a couple others. If you think about the Earth as a system, any system that has been in existence, a disturbance to that system will result in a reaction from the system. Typically, it'll balance the system. So I use this, if my arm fell off at the elbow right now, I'd start bleeding. My heart would respond by beating faster to keep my blood pressure up so I'd have oxygen going to my brain so I could finish this talk. And I'd most likely grab over here and try to squeeze. And a disturbance has occurred to my system, and there's a reaction by that system to try to maintain it. The Earth is a complicated thing. It's the most complicated thing that we know of in the universe, right? We're on it. Everything we know is on it. And yet, we don't know what's going to happen if more carbon dioxide goes in the atmosphere. If more heat starts to rise up, what's going to happen? Are there going to be more clouds? Is that bad or good? Will it reflect solar energy or trap it? Are there going to be more trees that produce more oxygen and scrub the air of carbon dioxide? What's the response of the system going to be? We don't know. We likely never will completely understand the response of the system of the Earth to a disturbance, just because of its complicated nature. And we can count on the Earth responding because it's a long surviving system. A system that can stay stable for a long time is around a long time. We still have our atmosphere. It hasn't flown off into space. We still have 21% oxygen to breathe. It doesn't go out of whack and we're breathing nothing but methane. So the Earth has these feedback mechanisms that respond to disturbances effectively. Here's a fourth thing. Predictions are hard to make. Makes sense that making a long-range prediction about an extremely complicated system is a very difficult thing to do. So, want to make a bet? If you want to bet $100, you know the temperature right here next Sunday? How about $1,000 that you know the temperature and the humidity here a year from now? How about $10,000 that you know the temperature, humidity, barometric pressure 10 years from now? And that's $100 billion. $100 billion that you'll know the global temperature 50 years from now. I mean, if you think about it, it's a pretty arrogant assumption to be able to make a prediction like this and demand that this was an estimated cost for an economy to reduce CO2 to prevent this from happening. It's a pretty bold prediction to be making. So we have these problems with global warming. It's not subject to scientific method. It's made inaccurate predictions. We don't even know if the way it's written and being changed around, if it can ever prove that it's wrong. If people just take everything as evidence for it being correct. We know the Earth has feedback mechanisms that stabilizes disturbances to it, and predictions with complicated systems are difficult. So now, with all these problems, why is global warming theory so influential and prevalent and part of the zeitgeist, right? Well, I'd propose that it's idolatry, a modern version of an old problem. So you've probably seen these pictures, and they talk about melting of the ice caps. First of all, this is a mother with her cub. I gotta say this, I don't even know if it's part of it, but does anybody know what's gonna happen to those polar bears when that iceberg melts? They're gonna get wet. They're not gonna drown, right? Because a polar bear can swim 25, 40 miles in the open ocean. So the photographer took that picture and probably watched him jump off there and swim away. They make you think, oh, that polar bear is gonna drown if we don't do something. Now, different image. This is the god Molech right here. You see a couple here, husband and wife, presumably. Mother and father, this baby. And you see this priest of Molech. There's a smoke coming from the fire that's in Molech's belly right there. So it's an old problem, a different name. How do we get into this idolatry of global warming theory that we're in charge of the Earth? Well, it's the same old problem. If God doesn't exist, if our God doesn't exist, the God who controls the world doesn't exist, or he exists but he's not in control, we start becoming captive to our own reason. to go back to Molech here. Just one of the references from it, you know, in Leviticus, you shall not give any of your children to offer them to Molech and so profane the name of your God. I am the Lord, Leviticus 18:21. So you go think back to that picture of those parents handing that baby over. How do they hand a baby over to be thrown into a fire and burned up? I mean, do they hate their baby? Or do they have a bloodlust and they just want to see murder done? I don't know that culture, but I'm presuming it's kind of what happens to us or to the natural man when he's not thinking of God. Throwing the baby into the fire is a reasonable act for that mother and father. Throw the baby in there, Molech's pleased, your family prospers financially, physically, or your tribe is saved. And it's not only the reasonable thing to do, it's a righteous thing to do, to throw that baby in there. To save those polar bears, we've got to do something. It's the right thing to do. It's a righteous thing to do. If we don't do something, we're going to cook the earth and we're all doomed. We're not going to need you to throw your baby into a fire. You're just going to have to make sure there aren't as many people around, because people breathe, people burn fossil fuels. We're going to have maybe less energy, so we don't have all these fossil fuels around. By less energy, I mean instead of 68 in the winter in your house, maybe 62, maybe 58. Or in the summer, Alex, I know you have ice that freezes on the wall in your house sometimes. but just kind of what people, even luxury, and by luxury I mean bright lights that you can do work by, dependable engine that can pull that can run the ambulance to the hospital. And of course, more taxes, more laws, more fees, more control. That transformation, that radical transformation of society. If you kind of say, hey, I don't know if I'm on board with this, hey, the science is settled. You've heard this maybe from the president, from other mouthpieces. So don't be the dummy who disagrees with all the PhDs in atmospheric chemistry from University of Virginia and da-da-da, an international panel on climate control from the UN. You know, with this, I don't know if I had this thought about this, but I always think of the emperor has no clothes. You know, the emperor's been conned by some tailors, and he's marching down through the parade, and he's wearing such fine linen that it can't be felt or seen or touched. And it's because he has no clothes on, but everyone's afraid to say anything to the king because they'll look like a dummy because they don't appreciate the fine tailorship or seamanship, seamstress work that's been done there. So how do we deal with all this as Christians? I like nice statements of fact, simple, can't be taken any other way. Psalm 24:1, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein. If you know who made the world, who's in charge of the world, you know that we're not going to be putting the world into a frying pan. Then in Colossians 1:16, this is speaking of Jesus Christ, for by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. So the earth is for Christ. We're for Christ. And to think that we can destroy that when he owns it and it's for him. Colossians 2:8, this is approaching maybe that emperor has no clothes issue. See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit, according to human tradition, according to the elemental spirits of the world and not according to Christ. Don't get pulled in by becoming a captive of man's reasoning again as your sole source of truth and understanding of the world that we live in. And remember, stewardship is not ownership. We're going to be called to account for our stewardship of all that the Lord has given us and the earth, his creation, as part of that, but we don't own it. And I pick this title here before Dan picked the song, or we didn't know that this was going to happen, but it's appropriate. God's creation, though flawed by man's sin, is magnificent. It's bountiful. It's resilient. I remember Pastor Ashbrook talking, or maybe it was one of his Sunday school lessons, about how God's made the earth. And if you take a walk through the woods and you look at something up close, a plant, a stem, it's magnificent the way it's designed. But then the earth also has everything that we need. It has water for us to drink. You can put a seed into the ground and pour water on it, and it'll grow food. We have trees that we can build houses from. There's minerals that you dig out of the ground. There's things that we can burn. There's metal that we can use. There's jewels that we can have to adorn things. It's bountiful. We now have the most people ever on earth, and there's plenty for everybody. You think of famine, that's always man-made. If you get to the root of it, it's not because we can't grow enough. So the Lord's given us the earth for our benefit and to reveal a part of his glory to us. If we remember that the earth is the Lord's and we are his stewards, take good care of the earth, but don't get in the place of worshiping the creation instead of the creator. It'll keep us with a proper mindset when we approach this issue of global warming. And then finally, we have confidence that we know that the Lord has a plan for the earth. It's not a great plan if you're natural man, unsaved, but if you're a believer, what better news is there than this? You see a new heaven, a new earth. You get to live there. Sin's not there. Death's not there. You know, it's just something that's glorious to look for. It allows us to have confidence in what God has for us here, what he has for us in the future. It allows us to see the limitations of man's reasoning, and allows us to avoid being taken captive by the new idolatry, global warming, the idol that's wrapped in scientific legitimacy. And instead of despairing about the future, we can look forward to the future. So that's all I have.